question is what happened in these two cases? I think it's much clearer in the Haftarah, in the story of Uzzah, over there what happened, so we'll deal with that case. And since it's the Haftarah, which was placed here to help us understand the poor weekly portion, so we'll move in that direction. There is an emotion which is well known as a religious emotion. And basically, we relate to God based on this emotion, this feeling towards God, and towards based on our whole religion. And that's what keeps a person going. But however, like every emotion, there is a good and there is a harm, and you have to be very, very careful. In the extreme case, the prophets, I don't remember exactly the source, but I think it was in Isaiah, he says that God doesn't want your sacrifices. What God wants is justice and kindness. Now, the question is, how could Isaiah say that God doesn't want your sacrifices? If you look through the five books of Moses, I would say around two-fifths of the books is dealing with sacrifices. So how could Isaiah say that God doesn't want your sacrifices? The answer is there are certain laws that... let's put it this way. If you followed your religious emotions, you would never think that being honest in business has anything to do with the religion, you see? Or let's say, for instance, I find a lost article, should I return this lost article, you see? You would never think that this is a religious act. See, that's justice. Well, kindness, I mean, you help a person. I mean, let's say fasting a whole day on Yom Kippur, I mean, that's a religious act. You feel something for that. Bringing a sacrifice could cost you for an ox that you bring for a sacrifice, $400 or $500, you're sacrificing a lot of money. You feel, yeah, it's a religious act. But you're honest with your taxes, you don't feel that you're religious, you see? So what he's saying is if you only do the religious acts, you see, then you are not obeying God. That's not what God is asking you. God is asking you to follow him, to obey the Torah, to obey whatever halacha says, not to make up what you decide, what God should want of you, and not what your religious emotion dictates. You see? So the thing is our usually what happens is our religious emotion dictates exactly how we should relate to God. What we have to be careful is to make sure that our religious emotion only dictates that we should relate to God, but how we should relate to God should be dictated by God himself. It is God who should tell us what we should do, and not our feelings, our religious feelings, to tell us what to do. Okay? Now, in the case of Isaiah, that's an extreme case where people... I mean by an extreme case is where people keep the religious parts of the Torah, but they don't keep the other parts, which is not considered religious, or if they keep it, it's not very thorough. You know what I mean? It's the really where they... There's a certain feeling. Now, as you study the study of halacha, as you study halacha, and halacha becomes real to you, in other words, since God gave it to you, it becomes... This is just as real as any other act I do. There's nothing else. So then you start recognizing and you're able to live with the idea that I don't decide what religion is, and it's not my feelings which decide what religion is, but it is God, and only through the study of Torah can I know this. You see? Now, in the case of Uzzah is that what happened was is a man that has knowledge of halacha is in certain situations where, in his case, where it was on the sudden spot, the old religious emotion to decide that I decide that now is the time to protect the arrow. Nope, that's not your decision. That's not your decision to protect the arrow. You're very good to have that religious emotion, but never to tell you what to do. You want to be zealous, You must be thorough in halakha to know how to be zealous. You can't be zealous totally based on your emotion. That's dangerous. You see? So that zealousness, the old, by Uzzah and definitely by the two children of Aaron, where they were on a very, very high level, you see, definitely over there was a very deep emotion. It's not like in the case of Isaiah, where they flagrantly gave up the other laws. But over here, they kept all the laws and they recognized, but someplace deep down, that old emotion was there to make the decision, you see. And in this particular situation, their moment of zealousness, when they wanted to do something for God, there's a certain feeling, I want to do something for my Creator, snuck out. From the depths of their emotions, it snuck out, and they did the incorrect act. And for their level, they got the death penalty. You see? But the thing is, we ourselves have to be careful. We have to know that obeying God means literally that. Obeying God. Not making any decisions except based on what the halacha is. And even if I want to be zealous for God, I must have knowledge to be able to be zealous. And if I don't have that knowledge, I cannot be zealous. Okay, and insofar as what you asked about, what about a good motive? Here you see very clearly that a good motive will not save you. Therefore, a person must study. It must be based on knowledge. I mean, it's not just a feeling. You must have the knowledge of Torah to be zealous, to really relate to God and to do everything with all your heart. It cannot be without halacha. And therefore, there must be a knowledge, an understanding of halacha, so that you know how to care to keep this relationship. You see, that is the only relationship besides the knowledge of God, but insofar as our actions are concerned, our actions are only based on what God tells us. And even where we want to go beyond and be zealous, we must be very, very careful. Okay? The question from Kim is that since this person that makes a decision based on his religious emotions, its roots is in idolatry, because idolatry comes from the person deciding how he should relate to God. And therefore, the avoidance of idolatry is recognizing only that only God tells me what to do and I must obey him. There is a law called a Nazir, in English I think it's Nazarene, to where a person feels a desire to relate to God closer and he wants to give up his physical pleasures. And basically, the law of a Nazir is that he can't drink wine, he can't touch anything that's impure, he can't become impure by touching anything that's impure, and he has to let his hair grow for the month that his Naziros last, and then he shaves it off. At the end, he shaves off his hair, okay? Now, there are some types of Naziros that are praiseworthy, but that's rare, okay? But it's an interesting thing. At the end of the month, the Nazir has to bring a sacrifice. You'll never guess what that sacrifice is. Bring is a sin offering. Here a man wants to relate to God by giving up the physical. And yet he has to bring a sin offering. And our sages tell us why. Why? Because you don't have the right to give up the physical if God didn't ask you to. If God didn't ask you to give up the physical, then you should enjoy God's world. And therefore, even though you might see some righteous sages that do give up the physical, you have to understand clearly why. If you don't have the knowledge and you don't understand why, then you don't have the right to give up the physical. Why are you giving up the physical unless you understand why? That is a sin. You have to bring a sin offering for giving up the physical. If you're able to enjoy the physical world and you don't partake of that enjoyment, and there's no harm in it, I'm not talking about pleasures that are harmful, but there's absolutely no harm in it, you don't have the right to give it up. Why should you? God didn't demand it of you. unless you have some religious emotion that tells you physical pleasures are somehow wrong. Well, how do you know they're wrong? Who decided? Who makes the decision? That's what comes back to the first idea of the new month. Who makes the decision on the new month? Halacha. Who makes the decision on what enjoyments you should and should not have? Halacha. But don't make crazy decisions, because that's not what God wants. That's your emotions making a decision, your religious emotions. Religious emotions should only drive you to study Torah and to know the halacha and to understand the halacha. But the religious emotion shouldn't even make a decision what physical pleasures you should have or not have. That you can only know through study of halacha. The question is, let's say, for instance, a person does not know that something is wrong. Like, let's take the case, a person thinks that it's right to give up the physical pleasures, and they give up the physical pleasures, okay? Now, the thing is that you have to understand that you, objectively, you're doing something incorrect. Objectively, it's incorrect. Like, let's say, for instance, I'll give you an illustration. Let's say, for instance, you were living in the 30s or 40s, and you didn't know that there was any harm in asbestos. In fact, you played in the chemistry set, they gave you asbestos. With fire, you would play with it. Okay? And it doesn't burn and all these things. And because of that, you would get cancer. I mean, you are ignorant. You didn't know. Okay? What about a person that was raised in a society of idolatry? He has no knowledge what's right or wrong. He was raised in superstition. He cannot see the ideas. We can't blame him. We cannot blame anybody. We're not placing blame. But however, objectively, the Torah tells you exactly how to deal with that situation. It's not a question of placing blame. It's a question of objectively living in reality. That's why I said halacha is a reality. It's not just a religious thing that, you know, I'm a good person. But it's a reality. And if you don't live according to it, even if you don't realize why, God will send us out of the land of Israel. He'll destroy us. Whatever it is, you see, it has nothing to do. It's an objective system, and if you're ignorant, then you pay the consequences like in any other system. If you don't know, in other words, years ago when doctors didn't know about germs, they would go from a contagious person to help a woman give birth. They didn't know. They didn't know. But they paid the consequences. The same thing in halacha. You're right, we might be ignorant, and we pay the consequences, but we have to try. That's why we must get involved in study, just like we realize if we want to be healthy, we have to read certain journals or things to know the basic facts and know how to take care of yourself. Because if you don't, you're going to be harmed. So if you're ignorant, yes, you will be harmed because of ignorance. Okay? In other words, we're not here to place blame. We're only here to say that if you don't live according to a realistic system, then you pay the consequences. Now, God gave halacha to the human race. Each their own type. They might have different laws for different people. Whatever it is, your system, you're responsible to live by. If not, you get the consequences. Just like if you don't know about germs, you'll get the consequences of fooling around with germs. Okay? It's the same thing. It's a simple question of consequences, not a question of blame. What I'd like to do is just give a general overview of the Chumash from Bereishis, from the beginning to the end of Kings. A very, very general overview. The first book, Genesis, deals with the creation and the individual people that is the beginning and foundation of Judaism. Okay? The next four books of the Chumash is the creation of a relationship, a new laws, a system of laws of nature of a relationship between God and Israel. It's a new system that is part of the laws of nature. And how that system works and the foundation and beginning of that system is the first four books. Okay? Then after the system is created, then we need the land to live and bring out the system. So then Joshua deals with the capturing of the land and so that we could work the system. Now, Judges is an interim system between that. Now we have the country. Now there has to be a system how to work. Judges is an interim system between the beginning to the king. Now, there's a difference of opinion what the system of Judges, whether it was a bad and kings are better system, or, in other words, was Judges a weaker system and kings a better system, or was Judges a better system and the kings a weaker system? According to the one that says that Judges was the weaker system, he points to the story of the person that beat up his wife and kicked her out, and she went home to her father, and then he feels sad about it. This was before we had any kings, and he feels very bad, and he goes back to the father and to his wife. And the father is so happy, his father-in-law, and he brings him in, they have a party. Meanwhile, the guy wants to go back home, and every day that he wants to go back home, the father wants to make a party. And you see, he has a weak personality, he keeps giving in, but like any weak personality, suddenly he just says, I'm leaving. And it just so happened it was in the middle of the day. Now, in those days, they didn't have highways and motels, so if you're traveling in the middle of the day and you're not going to make it home, where do you stay for the night? So he found a city in this by the tribe of Benjamin, and it seems like there was a gang there, and they came and they wanted him, and he says, I'll give you my wife, and he sent his wife out because he was like he had a weak personality, so he gave up his wife to save himself, and they seem to have gang raped her, and she died, and then he sent a message to the other 12 tribes to what happened. And so they got very angry. How's this done? How could a tribe do this? So they went to the tribe of Benjamin. The whole nation got together, and they went to the tribe of Benjamin, and they said, give up the people that did it. But like tribes, they stuck together, and they said they're not, and there was a civil war, and the tribe of Benjamin was nearly wiped out. That's the last story in the book of Judges. Now, what it shows there, one of the commentaries says, that here you see that it was a weak system, because sometimes people act on their emotions and it evolves and it affects a national catastrophe, you see. But as soon as it gets to the national scene, then the king would intervene. With no king, again, things just happen. When things just happen, you can't allow things to just happen. So therefore, it showed it was an interim government, but then they needed a king. And this showed that they needed a king. That's according to the person that says that it was a weaker system. The other person says no, that judges, the term judges means that they ran the government. Now, what does judges do? They judge cases, so they took care of internal affairs, right? Now, whenever we have to go to war, you always see that God called on a particular person and told him he should go to war for them and take over, right? So you see that God ran foreign affairs. So that means the nation was much closer to God because there was a direct relationship between God and the nation. When the nation asked for a king, they needed something more physical for security, so God gave it to them, but now God related to the king, you see. So there was not as close to the nation as the as before, okay? So that's the book of Judges. But the book of Judges definitely is an interim. Then the book of Samuel, both 1 and 2, even though Samuel was not living in the second book, in Samuel 2, he's not living anymore. But the thing is, Samuel 1 and Samuel 2 represent the interim, in other words, the beginning of kings. In other words, the system, there had to be a system set up. Now, first it started with Saul, but Saul didn't do a good job, so he was kicked out. Then King David, there was a good relationship, and God says that your descendants will always be king, meaning that it became part of the system, that this was going to be the system based on King David. So that was the foundation of the system of kings than what actually occurred with the new system. You see, with the system of kings, that's in Kings 1 and 2, until the system broke down with the destruction of the first temple. What we're discussing now is, what is courage? The definition of courage, or description of courage, is to get the will and to force yourself to do something that is afraid, that you are afraid to do. There are two aspects to courage, okay? There is psychologically, what is courage? And then philosophically, what is courage? Okay? Right. So let's take psychologically what we think courage is. Two opposite psychological relationships to the world. And one is fear, and the other is recklessness. Person is reckless, okay? Then the question is, what is the subject? The subject of fear and recklessness. Help in getting the subject. Let's give an illustration for fear and recklessness, okay? By recklessness, let's say a kid runs in front of a car, right, to show off for his friends. That's reckless, right? You'd call that reckless, right? Fear is, let's say, for instance, a doctor tells you to have an operation. You're afraid to ask him a question or to disagree with him. Okay? Now, based on those two illustrations, what would you say the subject of fear and recklessness are? The subject is one's willingness to take a risk. Person will take a risk at any time, do anything for whatever motivates them, I mean, whether a joke or anything, whatever, while a person of fear is afraid to take a risk any time, even for his own benefit. To clarify, in other words, when you take a risk, you're putting yourself in a vulnerable situation that you can be hurt, okay? The means between these two extremes psychologically is courage. Here I mean that People have extreme emotions, you see. And whenever you have extreme emotions, they force you to operate in a particular way, not based on the reality. If your emotions are not drawn too far to this extreme or too far to this extreme, so then it allows you to operate straight in reality. Okay? So therefore, the thing is fear doesn't let me even protect myself when I should. And recklessness puts me in situations of danger when there's no reason to. Now, courage is the means that courage is that I don't put myself in danger in a foolish situation, but I'm willing to stand up or do something courageous to help somebody else or put my life on the line if that is what is demanded at the time. You see? So I have the ability to put myself at risk if there's some advantage or for justice or for some reason like that. Okay? I have that ability because I'm not pulled from one side to the other. But if I have an extreme emotion, then it doesn't allow me to act correctly in a certain given situation, namely where I'm put at risk in somehow. Where I feel some danger, I back off by a fear. If I'm reckless, I'll put myself in danger, even if there's no reason to. You see? While courage says, no, you can put yourself in danger, you can put yourself at risk, but however, it should have a good reason why.
The question is, if a person is, say, in a war, and someone is out in a firefight, and they're hurt, and a person is watching this, and despite the fact that they're scared to death to go get them, they crawl through the brush and do it, even though they're risking their life. They're very, very fearful, but they're also doing something very courageous. So how does that square with the idea that this is a balance between fear and recklessness?
He doesn't know what he's doing. He loses control in fear of a battle. And there are cases where a person loses control, and he really doesn't know what he's doing. He does a crazy thing, and everything works out well, and they win the battle. I'm not talking about that. That I wouldn't consider courage. that I would consider fear going to, you know, like going like a breakout, you know. But it's, I wouldn't call that courage. But I would say that if the person realizes this is correct to do in this situation, you see, and he has an emotion of fear, but he doesn't let him, doesn't control him, then I would say that's courage. Clarify the last question that might help us a little more. We have to ask the question, philosophically, what we're talking about up until now, psychologically, what is courage? Okay? And we came to the conclusion that it's in the category of taking a risk, a willingness to take a risk, and it's the means between recklessness and fear. But however, philosophically, we have to ask, what is courage philosophically? Now, what I mean is like this. Recklessness is when I do something irrational. In other words, let's say, like we said, like a kid will run in front of a car, put himself in danger to show off for his friends, okay? Let's say, for instance, a German during the Second World War would go out and win a battle against, you know, and go out and do a courageous act and win a battle, okay? Now the question is that courage? Typically, I would say definitely the guy has courage. Why? Because in his framework, he is doing what is right. So therefore, that's the right thing to do, and it doesn't stop him. He wouldn't do this in a regular case. He's not reckless, and he's able to carry out in his framework what is right. So psychologically, he has courage. But I would ask, since the guy is fighting for an unjust cause, you see, so then in reality, this guy doesn't have courage. Because in reality, since he's fighting for an unjust cause, so he's doing a reckless act, because it's just no different than the kid that's doing a stupid act to make himself, in the eyes of his friends, right? So this guy is also doing a crazy act. The only thing is he doesn't realize it. I can't help that. But objectively, he's doing a crazy act because he's doing an unjust act. Do we take in consideration the fact that he doesn't realize yet? And that's why I said in his framework, he's doing an act of courage. But objectively, what is real, then he is no different than that reckless kid that's showing off. Because the thing is, it's doing an irrational act.
To the other side.
Not to the other side, because he's fighting for an unjust cause.
Because he knows.
He doesn't know that, but objectively, He is doing a stupid thing. In other words, like this. Let's say for instance, years ago when I was a kid, you had to eat liver. Okay. Now today we know liver could be too much liver. It could be bad because of cholesterol and for other reasons too. Right. Okay. So therefore, when I ate liver when I was a kid, so that was a healthy thing. But objectively, it might have been killing me. You see. So objectively, I was wrong. Objectively, I was wrong. We can't help it that objectively I was ignorant. But the fact is, let's say, for instance, in those days, kids played with asbestos in their chemistry set. I had a chemistry set that I remember distinctly playing with asbestos. Now, the thing is that, okay, there was nothing wrong. It was a learning toy, right? Like you're learning something. But objectively, it could have been killing me. So therefore, it was a foolish thing to do. So the thing is that so therefore, you have to make a distinction between the psychological definition of courage. In other words, that German soldier psychologically had courage, because in his framework he was doing the right thing, so he wasn't reckless, and he was doing what he thought was right. But objectively, he was doing something stupid, because he was fighting for an unjust cause, which is definitely destructive to the person that is doing an unjust act. Whether you know it or not, it's definitely destructive to the person to do an unjust act. The question is that how does courage, in other words, we understand the psychological idea of courage. When it comes to the philosophical, I mean, the fact is, he didn't know. He didn't know that it was wrong. So, I mean, the fact is, he did an act of courage. The answer is that philosophy looks at life from an objective point of view, not from your personal framework. Psychologically, we want to know who you are. That's all we want to know psychologically. But philosophically, we want to know objectively. Like, for instance, medicine, okay? Now, years ago, before they knew about germs, they didn't know, they were ignorant, but they were killing people. The ignorance were killing people, you see? Now, the thing is that objectively, you are destroying yourself by living an unjust life. Okay? That we discussed many times, that an unjust life is not in line with reality, and you will be destroying yourself. Now, whether you know it or not, if you are living an unjust life, it is destroying you. Okay? So it's destroying you. So therefore, philosophically, which is looking for the objective view of life, then that German is destroying his soul, and is destroying his outlook on life, and his value system, what he's fighting for, is destroying him. But however, psychologically, that I would call an act of courage psychologically. But philosophically, let's put it this way. Philosophically, which situations should I use courage? That philosophy has to dictate. Person should have the emotions and the psychological strength to live a life of courage. But what situations you should use that courage, that reality has to dictate. In other words, to that kid, let's look at the mind of that kid that runs in front of the car. Everybody thinks that, he has a lot of courage. The kids think that way in their framework. They think he's great. He's outstanding. He put his life on the line and he came back, you know. They look at it as outstanding. So in their framework, they look at it as recklessness as courage, you see. Now, I'm saying that if we look at a psychologically courageous act, it could be philosophically very destructive to the person, and I wouldn't consider it a courageous act because it's not based on any wisdom. It's based on his feelings of country or whatever. The feelings are different feelings, that it might be, unjust. Philosophical gives you the ability... The psychological... courage gives you the ability to have courage. Okay? The philosophical idea of courage is which motivates you in what situations to use that courage. As a overview, the question was, what is the whole story about Samson? We can't answer all the details, but we'd like to give an overview of the life of Samson and why he came into existence. What was his purpose? Discuss the story of his parents and how the angel spoke to his parents. I'm going to start where Samson himself comes into existence to show the story from there. Of course, there you have to get into what an angel is, and that's a very abstract idea. Okay, that we'll leave. Okay, we're just discussing the story of Samson and his life and what his purpose was and why God brought him into existence. And the thing is that my interpretation is based on a few different areas. One of them is Rabbi Chait. Many, many years ago, he told me a basic idea and some of the commentaries, so a few different angles. Okay? In Judges chapter 14, and in verse 1, 2, and 3, the story basically is that Samson saw a woman from the daughters of the Philistines, right? And he told his father and mother that he saw her and he wants to marry her. And his father and mother said, "Are there not enough women in our nation, in the Jewish nation, that you have to go to the Philistines, right?" And Samson said to them, "No, I want her." Okay? Then verse 4 says, "And his father and his mother did not know that from Hashem," that this was from God, okay, "that he wanted to marry the Philistine." Okay? And at that time, the Philistines were rulers over over Israel. Okay? Now the question is, so we see that this whole story is really based on that God wanted it this way. And so what is what's happening? In other words, it's God's will that he should marry a foreign woman? How is that possible? And these were, idolaters. These were our captors. We were subjugated under them. Never would God want such a thing, that we should do such a thing. Now, how could in this situation, what did God have in mind, and how did Samson fit into that idea? The end of the very end of the story, it says that we were subjected under the Philistines of the time for 40 years, and Samson ruled for 20 years. In other words, Samson was the leader or was in action for 20 years. Okay? Now, if you go through the story carefully, you'll see that the Philistines were very, very busy chasing Samson, which means that they didn't have too much time to annoy the Israelites. Okay? Now, what it seems to be is that the Israelites were not close enough to God that they should be freed from being subjugated under the Philistines, but also they repented or was close enough that they should
have a respite
in their suffering. Samson was the break. Samson acted as an outlaw, so then the Philistines would have blamed the Israelites, and therefore they would have attacked all the Israelites. So what Samson had to do was he had to set up a personal situation that the world should recognize that he's an outlaw only because of a personal vendetta and that it has nothing to do with the Jews. Samson's life's mission. Of course, you are a messenger of God does not mean that God will protect you if your emotions make you make errors. And it seemed like he had one weakness, and that you see by the two women that he married, that if they pressure him enough, he will tell information which could be dangerous to him. And that was a weakness that he couldn't, that was just, you see, that under pressure, he gave out information. And that's what really got him into trouble. Situation put him in other words, his mission put him in a situation where he had to get into an area that awakened emotions which would make him make errors. And he was in a situation where he couldn't make errors because he was working as an outlaw all by himself. You see? So therefore he had a problem that he had to work out, which we see from the story that he didn't work out unless he did it afterwards, after he was blinded. But that seems to be, in general, the mission and the purpose of Samson. We're doing Kings 1, it's chapter 17, verse 8. And it says, and the word of the Lord came to him meaning Elijah, saying, arise, then go unto Zarephath, which belongs to Zidon, and remain there. Behold, I have ordained there a widow woman to sustain thee. Ordained means that he appointed her, meaning that she didn't know about it, but he told Elijah. Okay? So he rose and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, there was there a widow woman gathering sticks of wood. And he called her and said, fetch me, I pray thee, a little water in a vessel that I may drink. Okay? Now, he wasn't sure that this was the woman. Okay? In other words, God told him that there would be a woman there, but God didn't tell him who the woman was. So, and as she went to fetch it, he called to her and said, bring me, I pray thee, a morsel of bread in thy hand. And she says, as the Lord your God liveth, I have nothing baked, but a handful of meal in a jar and a little oil in a cruse. And behold, I am gathering a couple of sticks, that I may go in and prepare it for me and my son, and when we have eaten it, we shall have to die. Okay? She says that when he asked her for water, that was the same test that Eliezer gave to Rebekah. The question is, what is the test, and what's the purpose of the test? A lot of people are nice people, and, you know, if you ask for something, they'll give it to you. Now, I understand that Rebecca did more, and so did this woman. This was a time of a famine, and Rebecca helped him out with the camels also, which must have been a lot of work. I understand it was a lot, but still and all, so she's very nice, you know what I mean? But why does, for that, Rebecca deserve to be one of the forerunners of the whole Jewish religion, and this woman here is worthy of, having a house, housing Elijah, okay? So the question is what does the test show? Psalms of chapter, Psalm 2, in the, it's talking about anti-Semitism, about people coming against the God, against the anointed, meaning King David or the Jewish nation, and also, and via that to God, okay? And they say, these people say, let us break asunder their bands and cast away from us their cords. Meaning that they recognize that Judaism is, in other words, somehow they recognize that Judaism is somehow correct, and they're afraid to accept upon themselves the responsibility. So it's really the translation should be that they break their yoke, and also they tear apart their the straps that hold the yoke and bind the yoke onto the oxen. So the thing is, they want to break the responsibility. According to King David, this is the reason why people are anti-Semitic is because they recognize that it's real unconsciously, not consciously. They recognize unconsciously it's real, and therefore they hate it, and they try to deny it. And what they want to do is they want to break that responsibility. Okay? Chapter 2, verse 20, Jeremiah says, or God says to Jeremiah to tell the people, he says, from your did I break your yoke, in other words, the yoke of the Israelites, and did I burst asunder your bands, in other words, the bands that hold the yoke? And you said, I will not transgress. Nevertheless, upon every high hill and upon every green tree, you make us your bed as harlot. That's a metaphor for idolatry. Okay? So the thing is that, again, it uses the same term, and God says, I broke your responsibility. In other words, the anti-Semite says, let's break our responsibility for Torah. You understand, right? The responsibility for Torah. And then God says to the Israel the exact same language that I broke your responsibilities, right? And then you went to worship idols. It's totally contradictory to the idea. Psalm seems to say that Torah is a big responsibility, and that's why they don't want to accept it. And over here in Jeremiah it says that God says, I helped break your responsibility. So, I mean, it should be just the opposite, that, you've at some time in the past, you accepted the responsibility of Torah. That's what Jeremiah should have said. And now you're worshiping idols. But he says, in the past, I broke your responsibility, and now you go to the idols. It's just the opposite of the what it says in Psalms. Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 12, Moses says to the nation, and now Israel, what does God want of you? Only that you remain in awe of God your Lord. Okay, so that you will follow all his paths and love him, etc., etc. Okay? Now, when Moses said that all God wants of you is to fear him, to be in awe, fear him. So our sages say that was easy for Moshe. For Moses, to fear God, that was an easy thing because he was so close to him. But for everybody else, to fear God, who is not physical and not visible, is a very, very difficult thing. It's not as easy as Moses. Okay? So one of the greatest Torah scholars of the past generation, his name was Aaron Cutler, he asked the question, he says, that's a funny thing. In other words, because he's speaking to the people, he shouldn't be speaking in his own framework. He should be speaking in the framework of the people. So the question is why did he say this to the people? You understand? In other words, if there's something that you're on a certain level for, but you're speaking to other people, then you have to speak in their framework. And Moses knew the correct framework, how to talk. He was a leader. So the question is why did he speak in his own framework, not in their framework?